Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining. Today we should maybe finish this topic of genetic algorithms, the classical and most researched on algorithm in this field of natural computing. And then we will move on to other types of meta-heuristic approaches. Maybe still a little bit in the spirit of genetic algorithms at first, but then moving to other fields. Today, we should maybe consider this old discussion whether any meta-heuristic algorithm is comparable to, let's say, classical algorithm. And so people have said definitely yes, because it's always possible to run any meta-heuristic algorithm, for example, this genetic algorithm, as a hybrid algorithm, in the sense that in addition to this population-based search through the representation of solutions by the individuals, in addition to this, you can also add some other features. So any kind of classical or standard or more advanced algorithm can just be attached to a single individual. And so in this way, you prove or you can prove that the genetic algorithm, for example, or other meta-heuristic algorithms as well are just as good as other algorithms. So this is a little bit unfair comparison, of course, but necessarily it's clear that it would be a waste of energy to leave just every aspect of the solution to the genetic algorithms if there are some other possibilities. So just think of this discussion which we had last time about the comparison between genetic algorithms and simple hill climbing. So as soon as we are very close to a good solution, then why not just go the few final steps up by simple hill climbing? Or if you are in a newer area, then maybe it's also worthwhile to just move a little bit up the hill by just an adaptive or greedy search and to check out whether this region offers something nice. So of course, we have seen that it's not a good idea to rely exclusively on this, except maybe for some simple problems without local minimum or local optima. But it can definitely help to combine these different types of algorithms and genetic algorithms by this parallelity of the individuals definitely allow for this. So we will check out a few cases where this makes sense. And but before, maybe we should sum up a little bit these different steps which we have taken the last few times. So we have seen first this more theoretical description of genetic algorithm in terms of schemata or schemas, in the sense that certain properties which are in some pieces of the code represented in each individual, that these schemata have some kind of a good chance to survive if they are nicely represented in the way that they are short and that they are nearby in a sense. If they really contribute to the fitness of an individual on average, of course, because the schema also only specifies a few bits in this individual, and all the other ones are completely open or not decided by the schema. And of course, they, for each individual, they will also have some contribution to the fitness, such that the schema is only decided by its average. But the hope is, that's why this building block hypothesis was formulated. The hope is that many such schema, especially those which really contribute a lot to the fitness, are identified maybe by different subpopulations of the population of the algorithm. And by juxtaposing or by recombining these individuals which have on father's and mother's side, so to say, good schemas, then you arrive at new individuals in the next generation which have even better or higher fitness than previously. So this occurs very often, or maybe it should be formulated the other way around. So if there is a chance for this building block hypothesis being valid, then this problem is probably well suited for an application of a genetic algorithm. So this doesn't mean, as suggested by this idealized genetic algorithm or by this royal road function, that you are always able really to specify, to pick it out. What are the building blocks? So of course genetic algorithms by this search in the hypercube and so on will be able to identify them, but if you are not in this ideal solution, there is the chance that some hitchhikers, so to say, blocks which are not really building blocks towards a solution, but just some what is called in the real genetics this junk DNA, some kind of junk information, which just sits there and is somehow profiting by its selection or in the selection process, profiting by being next to other important schemas, and these hitchhikers can also in this way make it to the next generation, unless you make sure that, for example, there is an appropriate way of recombination, such that it's possible maybe to cut out bits of code. You know, if you just use maybe two-point recombination rather than just 1 point, for example, this can sometimes be helpful, or that you make sure that the environment is, or the population is large enough, and the environment is not such forcing so much the selection of only the very best ones, such that other combinations can also develop and later by recombination maybe replace these hitchhikers in order to move more closely to a better solution. So these were, just to summarize again, the possibilities. So obviously we would like to have these royal road functions which avoid both these hitchhikers, as well as maybe some kind of missing the important bits. But this is something which you should maybe attempt in a certain problem, but of course if this is so easy as in these cases, then it's maybe not really worth to run an genetic algorithm for this. Okay, so I just included this here for summary. It's probably not on your printouts. So the question was mainly, yeah, how to move on now. We had mentioned already this idea that it's maybe a good idea to run these genetic algorithms in different phases, in the sense that in the beginning it's important to scan a large area of this search space to emphasize more the exploration rather than maybe quick increases in fitness, which has a chance to end up in local optima. In the final phase of the algorithm, then of course it's important to exploit, so to say, the information that is acquired by the population, and to move really a little bit faster or towards the better solutions. If this fails, then you have two possibilities: as you restart the algorithms, possibly with slightly different values, or maybe you iterate between these exploratory and exploitatory phases, by just, for example, increasing and decreasing the mutation rate. That's just the same. So this idea to increase the gain of the algorithm or the progress in fitness has also led to this discussion of a memetic algorithm, or as it was traditionally denoted in the field of genetic algorithms, to include some kind of local search. So meaning, for example, that whatever, think of our walking machine, which we have discussed a few times. So the genetic algorithm maybe specifies some kind of length of the and mass distribution of the limbs of this walking machine, but it's maybe also a good idea to ask an engineer to calibrate a little bit before we make the next test. And so this genetic algorithm, which doesn't care really whether there was some kind of calibration done and just cares about maybe the distance this machine was able to walk. So the genetic algorithm would then select both a good configuration of the more physical aspects of this machine, as well as the fact that this machine is easily calibratable. Yeah? Or in a more general context, maybe we have some kind of learning abilities in our individuals, such that some of the properties are already provided at birth, yeah, are innate to the individual, but others are maybe acquired only in the first steps of life and well before the fitness is finally calculated, such that there's some kind of after mutation of the new generation, after the final step of the creation of the new generation, there is some kind of learning phase or adaptation phase, and only after this is fitness calculated and the next generation is discussed or is now analyzed again. So this has led to some kind of an sequel or cascade of new algorithms, mainly in the last 10 years, where on the one hand one tries to be closer and closer to natural evolution, yeah, like maybe in the beginning young animals are still under the care of the parents, and on the other hand also to have a more or a less severe effect of these choices which we had to make. Yeah, we were thinking about the encoding of the properties of the individuals into the genetic code, well, which I said might be difficult, and this would be better if the algorithm takes care for this, as well as maybe even the construction of the fitness function, yeah, which is not really specified from outside in natural evolution, and thus may also be maybe not exactly acquired, but at least refined by one of these higher order algorithms. So maybe the basic step is just to add some kind of local refinement, some well-specified algorithms, you know, maybe just some hill climbing in addition to these genetic selections. Then people have suggested maybe to go back to this idea of Lamarck, who before Darwin already had this concepts of evolution as an accumulation of experiences that were acquired during lifetime. Yeah? So that personal experiences will also be transmitted to the new next generation, which might not be really the case in natural evolution. Also, there are meanwhile some examples that show that this is not completely nonsense, but we are of course not, there's no reason why not to do this in a genetic algorithm, to allow for some learning, like in the more simple local search variant, but to transmit also results from this learning in addition to this maybe more structural information to the next generation, wires or in addition to the genetic code. And finally, of course, to make it like universal, there is a third generation. This is kind of slightly self-contradictory notion of self-generating mimetic algorithms. I should have said what is mimetic, yeah, in the first place. So the idea is that, of course, in biology, the properties of the animals are encoded in the genetic code and in this way transmitted to the next generation, but maybe in many animals, but certainly in humans, there are also a lot of other concepts or items translated towards new generations. So think of a fairy tale, for example. They are just invented at some point, or maybe spontaneously emerged at some point, and then they are just passed on. Maybe they are helpful for children, but at least they are having somehow alive on their own, and that it can live for maybe 100 generations. In slightly, of course, they mutate each generation a little bit and may also be fused with other such memes, but behave very much like what we have been talking in genetics already. So in this sense, there is this observation of a mimetic evolution on top, so to say, on the genetic evolution, and of course it makes sense to include such features also in the genetic algorithm. And whereas for the pure biological genes, it's not clear whether experience is influencing these ones. For the memes, on the other hand, it's definitely obvious that they are influenced and can benefit from our personal experiences and stories which are told previously, maybe even better in the next generation if there are some kind of relevant experiences included in these stories. There are not just stories, there are whatever religion or science, everything in this sense could be considered as a meme, which definitely may help also to the fitness of the individuals who carry or realize these types of memes. Finally, but the kind of what memes are produced or how they are evaluated, exchanged or distributed, this is something which we have to specify in these mimetic algorithms, but people have thought maybe there's a chance to have this kind of exploration both of this mimetic space, so what kind of memes should be selected, what kind of memes might be helpful, so maybe there could be also a discovery of new memes in these algorithms, and also there should be some kind of co-evolution of the genetic algorithm itself, so what kind of operators, what kind of mutation, what kind of recombination should be used in order to have maybe a maximal impact on the, or influence on the increase of the fitness. So in this sense it's very general and it's more like a hope rather than an algorithm which you can download from a website. But there are several features, so to say, of these third generation algorithms which are have shown to be useful. And we will not really go to this level, but we will try to have a look on some examples now which show how far this could go. This was mainly to contrast two events which are this Lamarck in the first place about the inheritance of acquired characters. Earlier reference for the mimetic algorithms and for the genetic algorithms. But what is also I should also mention this fact here that you maybe are aware of this. We know more or less the human genome, but it's also an fact that only a very small part could really be deciphered in the sense as we know that this bit, or this small fraction of the genes really code for proteins, so we know how they translate into something useful for the body, but the other 98.6% are either just hitchhikers, so to say, or might possibly also provide some kind of interpunction somehow, just there are these starting and stopping genes or introns which have a more structural effect to the reading out and copying mechanisms. But all the other, what is sometimes called junk DNA, all the other bits of the DNA probably have some kind of effect similar to these mimetic algorithms in the sense that they are also read out from the DNA. But of course it doesn't really last for a long time because if it doesn't make sense then this protein assembly will not continue and so this readout process will stop. But because this is all the time attempted by some of the RNA molecules, these bits of protein which are copied from the meaningless or apparently meaningless DNA have some kind of chemical effect on what's going on otherwise in the cell, or just by their presence, and also might interact with other chemical or maybe environment-related processes in the cell, such that there is definitely some at least chemical effect, and maybe also otherwise, which is not so clear, and might relate also to effects or interaction with the environment or with possibly personal experiences. Much before there was any discussion about what is the chemical carrier of the genetic information, there was this interesting suggestion by James Baldwin, now it's more than 100 years ago, but after Darwin, that even if you completely trust the Darwinian theory, there is still this chance that other factors are important in evolution, and there is some kind of a backdoor for these acquired characters to be important for the fitness of an individual. So just think of two individuals which are genetically more or less identical, and one of them by chance has a chance to learn a certain ability, then a useful ability, then the one who learned a little bit might have a higher fitness, and that's why it's more likely to transfer to the next generation, while the other one with exactly the same genes might be less fortunate and die out. So this is maybe something which happens just by chance, but on the long run, of course, an individual which maybe has just a slight mutation which enables this learning ability will have possibly a very big advantage to one which lacks this information. So that's that. Also, maybe there is some slight change, maybe like a learning rate which is encoded somewhere, or kind of just general activity to search for interesting stimuli in the environment, that these slight changes may translate into big differences, but only if they are really realized in the environment, if this kind of learning ability is also used especially in order to increase the fitness. So in this sense, nothing has changed to the genes at first, except maybe some mutations have brought about this learning ability. But what happens, of course, in the second step of this Baldwin effect is the following. Maybe if you are born with a completely automatic program, then you are fine. But if you have to learn, like you do at university, until maybe a quarter of your life is already finished, or something like, or a fifth of your life is finished, then it has some kind of cost, you have to spend some effort with this, and so it might be a good idea to bring forth children that are already born with this kind of knowledge, which other individuals have to acquire with some kind of effort only. And so this was suggested by Baldwin, that as soon as the environment really requires some kind of constant abilities, so if the environment changes, it's maybe really better to stay on this learning track and to be more adaptable or adaptive to changes in the environment. But if the environment is sufficiently constant, then maybe it's a good idea, gradually or it would gradually transfer the learned abilities into the genome, just by some kind of mutations which happen to encode already some kind of first steps of the learning. So maybe in a couple of generations from now, children are born being able to read already, just by some kind of mutative exploration of these possibilities. But what is more interesting is that there is some kind of an advantage to those who are able to start immediately with a certain ability, rather than to have to go through a longer or shorter learning phase. And so if the environment really stays constant, then this process will continue and always give some kind of advantage to those who have more innate properties towards a learning goal than those who don't, and will end up with individuals which are born already with the learning abilities. Of course, this requires a very stable environment. If the your fitness points are distributed meanwhile for completely different abilities, then it will not really be helpful. But this was a very nice suggestion, at least to give some kind of an explanation that Lamarck was not completely wrong, and there is this chance by this two-leveled process of first being able to learn something and then slowly guessing, so to say, genetically these results of the learning by some kind of selected mutations due to the advantage by avoiding the learning cost. It was very interesting that it took really a long time, really like 90 years, before there was some kind of more clear understanding of this effect. So they provided some kind of a model for this, very, very simple model, very much in the style of these all ones or something like this, but somehow before 87 nobody really did it. But today, of course, for example, if you think about evolution of robots, it's really important that you cannot really spend thousands of generations, but you want to have it maybe in 10 or 50 generations. Such abilities are not only used but maybe also adapted in the sense that especially the second part of the Baldwin effect can maybe be accelerated by cheating, so to say, and writing information into the genetic code rather than waiting for the mutations to have guessed about this. So it's a very interesting concept, which probably has not really, it was introduced into theory only rather late, which probably has not found its full appreciation. But it's becoming more and more used. A slightly more clear example of this mimetic approach to genetic learning is maybe here given by this example, which depends a little bit how much you know about, whether it's clear or not, depends a little bit about how much you know on whether you know much about neural networks. Have you studied this at some point? It's really like half and half, which makes it not much easier. But neural networks are not something to be afraid of. It was invented maybe about at the same time as genetic algorithm, and it was somehow termed statistics for dummies. So if you don't want to do statistics, then you rather train a neural network, just as genetic algorithms are. Here's some chalk. Genetic algorithms are problem solving for dummies. Yeah. So the idea is simply you have a certain set of nodes, which is probably on the second slide here. You have a certain set of nodes, so each node referring to some variable, just a single scalar variable, which forms an input vector to a function. Well, for example, you would like a typical application is you have a time series x of t minus 1, this is maybe the rainfall today, yesterday, and the days before. Yeah, maybe you have a number of these, t minus 2. So you put in here x of t minus 1. And that's the idea is there some kind of generic structure which is able, whatever kind of complex function tells us rainfall for tomorrow, whatever kind of complex function we have, to realize this function. So what you need is a universal function approximator, and it was really proven that neural networks do exactly this. Any type of function can be represented in this way, that you have maybe some kind of output unit, which just is a symbol for this desired value which we have here, And then you put some kind of intrinsic or hidden nodes. So these are visible, yeah, because we need to be able to put our measurements into, and there is this output unit which is meant to calculate for us the new value. And what we do, all we have to do is to, two things. So each of the hidden units receives or calculates essentially just a weighted sum. Yeah? So what is going on here? Maybe this is value, I'll call it maybe y of the ice hidden unit. It's just a sum over all the inputs with some kind of specific weights, ij, xj. And we need to do also one other thing, namely to calculate. So this is just linear sum. We need to calculate some kind of a nonlinear function. This is important. And by these two, by a nice nonlinear function, for example, hyperbolic tangent is often used. By these two ingredients, choosing here the correct weights and choosing here some sufficiently or some appropriate nonlinear function, then we can do this calculation of xi. So maybe we write here a 0 for zeros level and here a 1. And then we just do the same for the output. Again, same function, but maybe different weights. Kx1k, yeah, something like this. So this is already all we have to do, and all the discussion in neural networks is how to find these Ws. Yeah? The G is often less critical, but Ws are important, so how to find these Ws?
Are two layers in general enough to approximate any function?
Yes. This doesn't mean that it, in some cases it's better to use several layers, especially if it makes certain sense. So if you want to do, for example, language understanding, maybe you like to have one layer for some kind of low-level features, one layer for phonemes, one layer for syllables, such that you can inspect a little bit or to help a little bit or something like this. But mathematically, two layers are enough. Yeah. Of course, I didn't say anything how many neurons you need in the hidden layer. So this depends on the complexity of the function and is some weak point, of course. Yeah. But in principle, that's enough. Yeah. Okay, so. And it's not so trivial how to determine these, and there are a number of algorithms mainly derived from some form of gradient descent. But as much as you have followed the course so far, you will easily guess it is also possible to use an genetic algorithm to find out about these weights. This could be a good idea if you really have a huge computer and sufficient time and a sufficient simple problem, because obviously this W need to be continuous values, and this is always not so nice. But what is much easier in this context is to think maybe a little bit about this structure. Yeah? So this structure, how many maybe. This could be an parameter, how many input values you want to take. So it's not obvious whether you need really a lot of previous days or whether the rainfall just depends on what was yesterday. It's not clear how many hidden units you have. Maybe sometimes you take all this kind of bias units, which always have the value of 1, which could be helpful, things like this. Or maybe you could also try to test here other nonlinear functions for this, or maybe sometimes you would like to have this kind of connection. So everything, this kind of structural information, you could easily incorporate into a genetic algorithm, and the genetic algorithm would probably search these not so much these weight space, which is for each individual different, but much more this. Structural configuration space in a very nice way. So how do we calculate this? There is some example here, but maybe I just draw it. So what you do is you just number all the units, yeah, because now maybe 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, yeah. Maybe we need to add somewhere, but it doesn't really matter how we number them, just we keep the numbering. So and we just write some kind of a matrix from 1 to 11. And so we have here, for example, if this is 6, so from 1 to 6 we write a 1, from 2 to 6 we write a 1, 3, 4, and then we have from 4 to 11, from 4 to 11 we also have a 1 in this case here, yeah? And from 6 to 11 as well, maybe here's a 6. So here everything else would be 0, but the genetic algorithm can just do some kind of permutations and in this way identify a good structure. And what should be a fitness function in this case? The fitness function is simply, so we take a very long time series of the rainfalls, all the data we have, and so setting maybe t to yesterday, then t plus 1 would be the day today, and we give all the previous days into our machine and check whether the outcome is really what we know about today. And if this is so, then or the deviation gives us some kind of negative fitness points. So in all these neural networks, we are required to have some example data, and the neural network is supposed to identify this function which connects the sample data, and hopefully in such a way that it can also be extrapolated for other instances of these ones. And so this is already more or less is. So in this way you have a genome which implements this matrix, or if you want to add a few more digits, maybe for bias units or for nonlinear choices of nonlinear functions, then each individual needs to be trained. You need to check for some kind of standard algorithm for training this W, and you really will find that some training algorithms, or maybe a fixed training algorithm, will work differently for different connectivities. So if you just have this one, maybe it's not really a good idea because it calculates essentially only one like feature of the data. If you allow for other features, so this could maybe be the feature, it's now summer, or it's now winter, and it's and this one is maybe the air pressure. So it's not really clear whether these hidden units really develop these ones, but we know that these indicators or features are important to make a prediction on what's going on next, even if you have all the data. And so it's likely that these features here inside are related to something like this. And if you specify, it's very similar to this idea of building blocks. So neural networks often identify such important features if they are really important, but somehow they may also have some kind of mixture between these ones. But whatever features are identified by the neural networks, more features probably are better. Too much is not so a good idea, because this learning or this local learning, local search for good parameters might just get not to an end if you just use, for example, a fixed time for the adaptation of the parameters of each individual. Maybe also parameter initialization could be put into the genome rather than the particular values of the parameters. Also, I mean, people have tried this as well to arrive at the correct parameters. So in this sense, there is this chance not only to solve the problems, to identify the function, but also to find out maybe a little bit about the structure, both in terms of the problems or whether it's really a meaningful structure, but at least more likely in terms of a structure which is very nice or very nicely suited to the particular learning task. And people have tried this also in other instances. So in the very end, I gave here this example of these neurocontrollers. So here in this sense, also some neural networks, also with a kind of non-standard structure, for example, with these looped self-interactions and shortcut connections, have been trained as controllers for such a card pull problem. So you have this small card, and on top of the card is an inverted pendulum, and you are supposed to keep it upright by using information from the position of the card and maybe the angle, as well as some kind of angular velocity or velocity of the card. And so it's not really a difficult problem, but it's not really obvious how to do this. And so here in this case, these kind of neuromodules have been evolved that really solve the task. And what you, if once you have this, you can also try maybe to do the same task with less information. So here's not, so of course it's a good idea to know whether the inverted pendulum is just falling down or whether the rod is actually moving to the correct directions to approach this optimal vertical position. But what is tried here to do without this information, and so what happened is that the algorithm developed this self-interactions, these loops here, and these loops come with a negative sign, maybe have developed a negative initial state, or can be trained also towards a negative weight. And so this effectively just calculates this missing differential, which is apparently needed by the control algorithm, but by avoiding to feed it in to the network, the network has to come up with some kind of creative solution to cope with such a problem. So now we jumped a little bit too much here. Yeah, I guess you have noticed this already for the assignment, but here for this kind of evolution or genetic evolution of some meaningful structure, it's also very important to make sure that you respect the structure of the problem. So for example, if you assume that this feature has the meaning of the season of the year, then maybe it's not a good idea to do a crossover with another individual representing a very similar structure and just to cut out these two, but leaving these intact. Yeah? Maybe it's a good idea, once you have this concept of a certain feature arisen in the network, to conserve it at least as much as possible. Of course, you can do mutations to have slight maybe refinements of these concepts, but just to cut it into pieces might not always be a good idea. And there was this, there is this idea of, I don't know whether it's really an idea, but this suggestion of Montana and Davis, who said if you want to do recombinations, then do it for full sets of inputs to such a neural network. Huh? Similar here, maybe you should really observe also some kind of an, not only the structural bits, but maybe also what kind of features have arrived there. So it can easily happen that maybe there is this feature A, B, C here in the hidden layer of this individual. In another individual, well, it's as good more or less, but yeah, there's no reason why to put A here in the first part. You can just have a different arrangement of the features in the hidden layer. And so, but if you do a crossover, then there's no chance really, even if you observe this Montana Davis idea of not cutting the groups that belong together into pieces, then you arrive at descendants with slightly redundant schemes rather than with a good combination of the parents, the parent state. So there might be a possibility. So what they suggest is this kind of innovation number, so you keep somehow track which individuals are still similar, yeah, and so that's why they calculate this nice tree, which gives some kind of an idea how these genetic algorithms are running. So this is again here for this pole balancing task. Also, these authors arrived at much more complex networks for solution of this problem. So what you see is here is that maybe in the beginning there are a lot of nameless individuals which do not anything good, and only a few ones are highlighted here. So what you see is that There is at some point some kind of an individual which achieves some fitness value, but it is not really able to improve, so at some point it dies out and leaves the population at this point. While very quickly, shortly afterwards, some new ones arrive, probably from the same ancestor who creates always these new individuals here. They are more successful and finally end up in a very good solution, or here this one in the optimal solution. So there are some kind of phases of the algorithm where not really much happens, where just everyone is trying to establish itself, and it's, in this case it's really important maybe not to put so much selective pressure, because it's not really clear at this moment whether this one is really better or worse than the other ones, because maybe all of them are not so good and only later a new one appears and needs also to get a chance to get through. So this much about these points, maybe to conclude, I would like to refer to this relatively recent paper, where also some evolution has been performed. And it was funny, you have this population not only of like abstract individuals, but each individual means a robot. And so they are grouped into 10 like peoples. And so what they have to do is they have to find some kind of food source. They can also give some kind of signals to other individuals in order to tell their teammates, so to say, there is some food, just join me and you can feed as well. And so initially it's quite successful, so they are able to learn to move, and they are able to learn to move to the correct direction, and they also help those individuals which are similar to join. But after some kind of mutations and recombinations, then what happens is that the robots become more and more selfish, which is not just morally bad behavior, but of course suggests also that they became, all of them became so clever that they can find the food by themselves, and such that they don't need really to rely on this additional signaling. Because of course, and this becomes more important in the evolution, maybe the other types of robots might profit from this, and they want to keep it in this kind of group. So it's just this kind of funny experiments which do not really explain much about the real evolution, but it's somehow a successful experiment of evolution in robots on the one hand, and on the other hand it seems to be quite a lot of fun to work with these kind of huge herds of robots to explore certain things. Okay, so this much maybe about hybrid algorithms. There are some more examples mentioned here, but I guess, for example, this one, that maybe you can also use this kind of hierarchical encoding, but you might need to make sure. So in this case, it's obvious that not all the genes really mean the same, and some of these, because they have much bigger effects, might be more need to be better protected than the other one in later hierarchical levels. So that maybe you need really to identify also mutation and recombination rates according to these structures. Again, very similar to this Montana and Davis ideas for the neural network evolution. So this is, please have a look at these examples which are given here. And otherwise, I thank you very much for your attention and have a nice day.